Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Pino's question. Pino's a friend of mine. He lives probably 300, 500 metres away from this house. So I see him from time to time when he's walking his dog, picking up his kids and that type of stuff. And he's asked a couple of questions. So I'll tell you what they are first up, and then I'll get into them. The first one is he likes to listen to the podcast while he's driving, and he finds that his car can't play MP4 files. Sorry about that. I didn't know about that. Just would automatically assume that phones and various things can play MP4, but his car can't do it. So his question is, how can I get the MP3 files? How do I do that? That's his first question. And his second question is that this salesman tried to tell him that the particular glass in this U-Butte, as we call it. U-Butte is the Australian word for top-notch, or I don't think of the word for it. Quality, sort of binoculars. I'm just trying to convert into English binoculars. These are built by the Germans, and these are really good binoculars, and they have electron-activated glass. And he said, "Well, can you tell me a bit about electrons and glass?" I was on the phone. I was podcasting at the time. I said, "Well, mate, I'll do a podcast on that because there may be people interested in both those two problems." So let's first start off with. Now, the simple way to get the MP3 file is in the podcast. It will have the legacy or the older ones will have a big file name .mp3 at the end of it, and the more modern ones, where I've got that under control, it just says MP3 recording. So you right click on that. You put go down to the option as save as, and then the screen will come up. This is if you're on the computer, it'll come up, and then you navigate to your USB port or whatever it is, and the computer will download that file to the USB port. Now, I'm sort of really struggling with how to compress these files. YouTube can obviously compress them a bit more, and how you can compress them so they don't sound gravelly. So the I've sort of compressed the MP3 as much as I sort of dare. Sort of if I go for quality. Now, what turns out in the internet, they say that it's higher quality is the higher the number you go, the higher quality is. But it's actually, at least in the software that is available, the lower the number, the lower the quality is. So I've got it as quality 7 out of 0 to 9. That's what I got it. And that does variable bitrate. Now, I'll have to get in there. Unfortunately, I can only listen back to these podcasts on a $2, I say quite literally a $2 set of headphones. So I can't actually hear. I can hear it when it's really bad quality. So that's MP3. So this is how you can click on the MP3. And in future, it's going to it'll improve, reduce the file size. So just repeat. You go to MP3 recording, right-click on it, save as, and just dump it in your USB stuff. And as always, a bit of a comment can give me a bit of feedback, sort of tell me where to go on. Now, I'm of course chewing away at automation systems, and your first assumption is that it's me, not you. So we're looking at Blogger and what you can do with Blogger and what it does, and Feedburner and stuff like that. you find out after a while that that's going to be a dead end. It's going to be a disaster. You better migrate away from it. So you say, I'll go. Well, what I've done so far is migrate into WordPress. And so at the moment, it publishes it in Blogger and in WordPress. But then WordPress doesn't, is ostensibly, it's called a freemium. So it's free. Then the premium things where they want you to reach your hip pocket comes pretty quick and fast. So if you want to, at least the WordPress is just a order of magnitude more sane. If you've got an attachment of an MP3 file in your post, it's an automatic enclosure. The entire closure issue is gone, because that saves you a bit of work. And you could have seen that I had the long name of the file out, so I could check that it was in the enclosure before I did it. Migrated across here. So WordPress is a big step in the right direction. But then the moment you start wanting to do sorts of things, say if you want to have your WordPress to have some animation, so essentially at the moment I've got this rather dicky buttons that you press, and just trying to get around the blogger. So the blogger, it's for some reason you just can't put your style sheet information at the top of your blogger, and the style sheet doesn't go into your RSS feed and all the type of stuff. So you've actually got to put your animation close amongst around your HTML5 for the various buttons. So this is the buttons to do the quiz. There's the quiz, the jumbled word search. Now, being a teacher, I know the actual style that you need to press the button and it fills the board, and people at the background, at the back of the classroom, can see the quiz and can see the board, and it's got the right structure, at least to start off with. It's sort of lightweight, but can actually is suited for a classroom. So that's why that's there. But to actually push the HTML, CSS, Cascade style sheets down into your RSS feed, which is the feed that people who are looking at the blog to see what's coming out, to do that, that's really hard to do in Blogger. And feed burner, you're really scratching your head to go along here. So you obviously have some workarounds that you put up. And in general, why I have workarounds is that I can't tell, because I'm not doing it on Dreamweaver. I'm actually just putting it directly in Notepad, or writing a LabVIEW software to actually print out the blog post and things like that to get it in. And it's a real head scratch, because you can see people are going back and reading your blog, and then there's a different population of people who just read the RSS feed. So the long term is you'll go over to WordPress or something like that. But WordPress, immediately they want you, they charge a fortune for you to actually become, like, you move straight on to the professional package, which is a fair amount of coin per month that you have to put out. And that's just to give you access to their RSS page. My question is, that's almost insulting. I must admit, it's insulting that we're actually going to produce a package, and then we're going to actually cut it down as much as possible, so that if you want to do anything sophisticated, you're going to have to start paying money, which is sort of like a business case, but then again, question mark. Then there's press something or other to syndicate your blog, so you can automate printing to a blog, and then you can set it up to Cascade to produce stuff, which is all okay. And once you've got it automated, it's just a matter of, I just put in another another frame to if you're emailing it up to upgrading it to Blogger. Here I made it to Word, WordPress. It's okay, but then you've got to then once it's in Blogger, the feed burner watches it and produces the RSS feed, which is okay. It's sort of a bit of a head scratcher to read. Then the Blogger produces an RSS feed, which is okay. But then you go to WordPress, and it's a third-party thing to produce your RSS feed. Perhaps, yeah, look, that might be interesting. And look, bear in mind, an RSS feed is just basically a web page with the word RSS on the end of it, and a few headings and stuff like that to go through. So essentially, you get any RSS page and you just work out what it's done and then just get your computer to produce it. It's like it's nothing. But then again, in order to install a third party piece of software, you have to go premium on WordPress. Again, this is really an ignorance tax. If you don't know how to actually write an RSS page, well, you pay an ignorance tax to WordPress. I'm sure there is value in it, and producing value then. So down the track, it looks so like I don't know. I can produce the RSS feed down the track. I'll have to have a bit of a head scratch to work out how I do it. The sort of the only problem producing RSS feeds is that the speed with which I can generate an RSS feed on my side, the client side, but then it's got to upload it over a long period of time, and so while it's uploading it, it sort of brains it. So I've got to produce the RSS feed, which is easy enough. I might get it up, but then after producing the RSS feed, I really have to have it up there by one name, and then just simply do a name change. That's the fastest way to upload something, is to upload it slowly and then put it up there, and then when it's ready, you then do a name change. But I don't have necessarily the PHP, which is the server-side software, to actually do a name change up there, but I'll have a look at it. So there's all that structure up there, so that'll eventually get across. But thinking about that, that's, what, three months' work before that's ready, and then I've got to really have a real sense as to how that grows the audience, or how this works together with the overall rehab that I'm doing. So the idea is that I'm continuously exercising my brain to get myself thinking. So what the overall scenario is that work, you've had, there's, I don't know, 24,000 teachers in New South Wales. It's like a huge number of teachers. It's sort of mind-blowing, whatever, it's mind-blowing. And of course, there's a fraction of those which are having heart replacements, one or two which have whole heart, lung replacements now. And so you get a whole range of back to work policies. You can see people who are in with the establishment, they get a good back to work policy that the principal signs off that they bend over backwards. But if your people say, oh look, you're going to play funny with you, you get nothing. And so I myself have got nothing, and so I'm out there sort of while they're sort of poking me with a stick, so to speak, and I'm having to rehab the hard way by myself, and just feeling my way, saying, oh gosh, I really don't know what I need to do, or I think I'll go in this direction. I can't, I'll have to really work at it. So this is what this whole rehab thing is going along. So we're expanding, and I can't speak to my students. I don't have my students to work with, so I've got my mates which are asking various questions to go ahead and see how we go. And of course, it's sort of the classroom, I think, is sort of a global podcast classroom, and you don't have support here. You have to actually earn money. You just have to actually program one step at a time, be able to do your podcast, have a minimum amount of effort to then press on it and actually issue the podcasts. But then again, the solutions that you find, well, it's hard to say they're the best solution you can do at the time when you first read it, but then you reread it a second time, get more experience, you realize that what you think is what's promised can't happen. I'd say that particularly at Feedburner and Blogger, certain qualities are just not there. It's not, it could be you, but after a certain amount of time, you realize it's the whole system. And then you look at the next solution, have a little chew at it, a little sort of poke at it, and you realize, oh my God, they're going to charge me money for this. Look, I don't have the money for it. I'll have to do other things. So, Pino, we're 16 minutes in. I don't know how long your drive is. So we'll talk about electrons in glass. Now, one of the things that I have to get to, I've sort of mentioned before that you've got the classic picture of your atom, which is the Bohr atom, and that picture you have, which is on the with an atom with red and blue spheres like grape juice. It's called the liquid drop nucleus in the center, and the electron is a tiny little yellow thing orbiting, buzzing around like flies at a barbecue, to be not so crude. That picture's wrong. I'm sorry, mate, it's wrong. What the electron, what the atom is more like sort of beautiful Italian bun, soft Italian bun, fluffy bun, and in the center is a bit of grit, and that bit of grit is the entire mass, which is the nucleus, and that has no visible structure, external structure. So if you could magnify it and zoom it up, it would just look fuzzy. In fact, all things in quantum mechanics are fuzzy. So this is answering a question about electrons in glass, electron machine in glass, and there's a fair amount of story for them. So the first thing you have to know is that get your picture of the Bohr atom with the Bohr liquid nitrogen drop and the Thompson electron, which is a tiny little fritty bit. Get it up, rip it up, throw it over your shoulder, say, sorry mate, that's not it. I'm doing quantum mechanics now, and the first rules of quantum mechanics to get your mind around is that there are no surfaces, there's only fuzziness. So it eases in and eases out. It's sort of like driving smoothly in traffic. It slowly accelerates up to speed and then decelerates to speed, but where the speed is actually the amount that's there. It's sort of hard to do. There are no surfaces, so there's no surfaces of an electron, and there's no surfaces of the nucleus, and the actual nucleus sits through the electron. It's pretty hard to get to. So the electron is actually most easiness. It's not, I think the word of where is the electron most likely, that's sort of just really getting quantum mechanics wrong. And it's sort of like, oh, I don't know, asking someone a loaded question, have you stopped beating your wife? You sort of say, oh, look, I haven't been beating my wife. Oh, what are you doing? It's like, where is the electron? The electron, it's not in a location, it's isishness. The wave function, quantum mechanical wave function of electron is how is it is. Is squared. Electron, it really is squared. I think that's beautiful when you actually know wave functions that you have to square it to get the existence. It's the isishness. The electrons are most is in the very center. And it gets a little bit less is, and it's 50% is by the classical radius of the electron. So why am I telling you that? Well, because we're going to discuss electrons in glass, and to really understand electrons in glass, we've got to do electrons in metal. And I know that you are an electrician and, a real sparky. But electrons in metals, if they're not tiny little things and they're big fluffy things, how on earth do they get through a metal? Well, the electrons get through a metal because they're a wave, and waves are regular. So if you're at a beach, you look at the waves, it's a pretty regular type of stuff. And when the regularity of the electron hits, not necessarily, and the electrons actually don't see the nucleuses. So this is the entire thing. Electrons can actually travel through a metal without hitting the nucleus whatsoever. It's a crazy thing. But metals actually conduct electricity partly because of where the electrons lie in respect, the energy level of the electron respect to the nucleus. That's one area. But also because the nucleus is a crystal, and so it's a regular array of nuclei. It's a regular lattice of nuclei, and the electron is also a wave. So the electron actually travels through a metal simply because it's a wave. So electron travels through a metal the same way that sound travels through it's one way to describe it, sound traveling through a pipe. It's sort of an oscillation of an electron to get through to it. More on that later, but the entire thing is that if you try and think of an electron as a little dit, a little fly that's sort of crawling along through a metal, and the metal is all these cavernous emptiness, like the atom is mostly empty space, which is a lie, okay? It's basically a lie. An atom is mostly empty space, is just sort of like going up to a quantum physicist and poking him in the eye, saying, what's the problem with you, mate? It's sort of like, it was really offensive to say that. A metal conducts because of that. The electron wave function spans the entire metal. And so that's why an electron can actually travel through a metal, because the electron is as big as the metal. Yeah, get that around your head. The electron becomes huge, huge, thin, vapory, and crinkly as it gets bigger. But it's not a dot. Where the crystal thing comes into its real own, it's where you have a single crystal of silicon, and your computer that you're listening to, and every device you have, is not a jumble of they're single crystal. It's one crystal. So at one end of your computer, if there's a silicon atom at one end of the computer, and I get the coordinate of it, I can actually say, well, look, it's like knowing where a house is. In an apartment block, you can the apartments of a fixed size, I can know where all the apartment blocks are. So with the way that computers work is that it is a single crystal. It's the most amazing thing to get your head around. The electrons are big and they flow. And so this is the big discussion of things. Now, if you have something which is doesn't have the energy in a free level that they can actually expand and have a wave function which covers the entire crystal, it's an insulator. So say if you've got solid, well, I suppose argon would be one example. You can freeze argon and it's solid. That doesn't conduct, and it gets sulfur and things like that. But glass is a bit different. Now, the word glass, you say, oh, look, I know what glass is. Now, the common myth that I had was that glass was invented by Phoenician sailors who were marooned on the side of Venice. But we now know that that's not true. Glass has been discovered for a fair amount of time. So glass is basically silicon dioxide with a flux in it. Oh, no, it's basically silicon dioxide, but it can be selenium, silicon and selenium. It can be a chalcogenide. The oxygen can be replaced by any element going down the periodic table. So it's oxygen's in group 16. It's 1 to 16. That's 2 plus 10 plus 6 going across. 2 is for the two alkaline earths, then 10 transition elements, and then you've got your P block of 6 electrons, six atoms across. And that's the last one. The extreme end is the noble gases. Walk back one, you get the halogens. Walk back one after that, you get the oxygens, and that's called the chalcogens. And then the next one behind that is the nitrogen one, which is the nictogens. But that's got a funny spelling. It's P NIC nictogens. The chalcogens are the oxygen, sulfur, selenium, tellurium, and polonium as you go down. Now, the issue is that as you go down, the inner electrons are more, these become so massive they become a bit more metallic. So you can get various things that make up glasses, but the word glass does not refer to the substance. It's sort of like sand does not refer to silicon dioxide. Sand refers to a particle size. Clay refers to a particle size. Boulder refers to a particle size. Cobble refers to a particle size. Glass refers to the entropy or order. So if I've got a crystal and I know where one atom is and the next atom is, I can therefore work out where all the atoms are because it's a regular array. It's sort of like you've got your tablecloth and you can see that there's a little crisscross at one section. You can know that, well, a meter away I'll see the same crisscross. But if it's all jumbled like your tool drawer, you know that if I see a screw, a nut and a ball bearing in one section, that's going to tell me nothing about the rest of the drawer. But if it's a beautifully arranged drawer, yes, I know if I found one, I'll find the next set. So, glass refers to the actual disorder, a disorder of, and silicon dioxide is something ready for disorder. So if you say, imagine you have got you're building a house with straight bits of wood. This is it goes from point A to B. You can build a full house, but silicon dioxide's got the oxygen. Between any silicon is an oxygen, and that bond is not a straight bond. It doesn't go you from the silicon straight through the silicon through the oxygen to the silicon. It's got a bend in the bond, and what that means is that you can rotate that bond and actually vary the distance between any two silicons, and you can't actually build any regular structure with it because the actual orientation of that silicon bond can actually swing around and lengthen and contract, and you can actually squidgy. So I don't know if you can imagine building a cubby house for your kids rather than straight bits of wood, you've got these curvy bits of wood which can flex and bend, and eventually you just get a complete piece of garbage that your kid can't actually get through. If your kid gets actually stuck in it. And that's glass. So give you an idea of some things which are glass. So this solid liquid gas, the latent heat stuff, that's unfortunately a lie. Really is. It's a lie. It's something which causes me great pain to teach, and I teach it nonetheless. I do my duty. But the actual temperature transitions are associated with entropy, and so your real temperature transitions are glass. So it's actually not solid liquid gas; it's crystal glass gas is the major thing. So a glass, it's not the fact that the things can move. So the solid liquid gas is to do with the physical properties. That is, can it support a shear force, and you know, how can it compress? So liquids cannot support a shear force, or they deform underneath a shear force, whereas a solid will come to a complete deform and come to a complete absolute halt when it provides an opposite shear force. That's the definition. But in terms of energy and order, it's the entropy. And so glass refers to a high entropy object. So you can have a metal glass, that is, you're spraying something with metal. So most metal things that you have, most wires are crystalline. So if you get a paperclip, I ask you to get one, and you get it in your hand and you bend it back and forth, what will happen is that the crystal sizes will grow and it will fatigue and break up. And then if you look at the end of that paperclip really, really careful, you'll see, or say a metal coat hanger, but metal coat hangers are coming a premium nowadays, aren't they? They're all getting plastic and all this rubbish. But any piece of wire, if you bend it, not so much copper, but any sort of hard wire you bend it, it'll be all sort of white and gravelly, because you'll see all the different crystals. And you can come around here, I'll show you a piece of fatigued stuff. Look, a crystal thing is, say, convinces things that a crystal, look at some fresh galvanized stuff that you put in together, you'll see those big patches of different crystal areas of your galvanized roof, you know, when you first get it up. Look on here, you'll see these little crystal patterns, crystal areas, and that's not what a glass is. It's a glass is completely disordered. So that means a couple of things. One is that if electrons require a molecule wide wave function, it doesn't get that in a glass just due to the chemistry of it, but it also doesn't have the order to do to move with the glass. So electrons really cannot move in glass. So that's the major thing. Or they can move, but they move by actually being excited into the voids. Now this is, so if you can imagine, you've got your silicon and you've got your bent, between every silicon atom you've got an oxygen, which has got a bent of a bendy flexible bond, and you can actually clink them. I don't know if your kids have got bionicles or stuff like that, but you can actually bend it together. You can actually bend this and create so in a crystal you can see a void which goes right down a channel. In a glass, the voids are these little mini caves. I don't know if you remember the Thai kids who were caught in a cave. So they're these mini void caves. And if you are lucky enough to excite a free electron, it will sit in that void. And if you pull the electron through that void, it will actually tend to shape the void. So look, there's heaps of things I can talk about. But if you apply a large voltage to glass, the electrons do not move from the glass. The only thing that moves to the glass is ions. So if you've got some sodium ions or, you know, lead ions, anything which is a metal in a plus sign, so missing an electron, it moves to plus, that will be dragged through the glass. And this is called poling of the glass. And I've had some glass, and you apply a high electric field, the charge will move through that glass and actually be stuck there. That will be charged glass, and in fact I've charged up some glass, some optical fibers, and become quite sticky. It's an amazing thing. They come now. I should also tell you something which is also charged is glad wrap, a cling film. The cling of your cling film is because it becomes electrically charged. The charge goes there. Now that's electrons. A glass gets charged when the ions are pulled across one side, so you can actually pull all the positive ions up one end and the glass will become charged. But your cling film is an example of a charged device. That's the clinging. It's the cling film is the electrostatics of cling film to get going. So that's your Your glass. It is true that you can pushing electrons through glass does actually change the structure of glass. It actually doesn't change the individual bond, or very few bonds are bent, but the actual individual bonds are all tweaked. And though you can tweak a crystal bond, it's like tweaking a bread. You can push it down, it will spring up to the same level. But glass, it's in terms of this, is more like a haystack. You're sitting on a haystack, and it will deform with it. Now, the way to get electrons moving in glass is not electric fields. It's with ultraviolet light. So you fire your ultraviolet light into your glass, and you get the electrons shot out. Now, unfortunately, this is all quantum mechanics, and so your direction that the electrons shoot out is dependent on the polarization. So what happens is that when you fire an electron into glass, and the glass has an absorption center which can actually convert UV light into an electron. So the electron ionizes inside the glass, the electron shoots out. The electron will tend to shoot out from these centers along a preferred direction. So when you initially you fire electrons into a glass, it will glow yellow, or UV light into a glass, it will glow fluoresce. Eventually, as the fluorescence moves along, the holes in the glass will, the voids in the glass will relax a bit, and so you will eventually burn down. I've got these parrots which are attacking me, these king parrots. You'll get this fluorescence, but the fluorescence will bleach and burn out. But if you then turn your polarization around 90 degrees, I get the electric field pointing the other directions and send the electrons out at a different path, you'll reignite that glass. You can re-burn into the glass. And this burning into the glass changes the polarization of the refractive index of the glass ever so much. So you can actually write things actually into glass and change the refractive index of glass with ultraviolet light, firing electrons which actually fire through the voids. And the voids doesn't necessarily break bonds, but it actually caresses these flexible, rotatable bonds of the oxygen, which get you doing them. Now, that almost closes. We're up to 40 minutes. Should be a good move. But are you going for... Where are you going, Dal? Okay. I'll catch up with him. And, yeah, it's brought in. Sorry, it's my wife saying bring in the washing. Okay, so this is... the last thing I want to say about with electrons is that you can use electrons to machine glass. In fact, all these complicated military optics nowadays has... things, surfaces which you cannot polish. You cannot polish them up. It's just basically all polishing is based on spheres, and you just can't polish it. So they're all glasses made machinable and put in a CNC machine and machined down. And eventually, for some glass optics, you use electron machining. This is very small diffraction optics and stuff like that, very small optics. And this is a high-powered electron beam in a vacuum. Fires on the glass, and the glass ablates. And so you can make these very tiny wavelength of light structures in the glass, and you can actually machine diffraction gratings straight into glass. So we'll talk about that a bit more. So I hope this has been worthwhile, Pino. So I hope that you can actually click on the MP3 recording, right-click on that, and then save as to your USB, just to save your this podcast. And I hope this is something. And the great thing about this is that you can ask a little bit more about electrons and glass. I hope this is worthwhile. And I really think this is the future, because in general, expertise, what happens is that the expertise gets pushed aside. If you know something and it's not necessarily textbook stuff, it tends to be pushed aside and not saying. So I hope this is worthwhile and beneficial for you. See you later, mate. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.